I think we sort of come back to this, the fundamental idea that a company is people and people are relationships. And we come from a place that we are incredibly mission driven. And the mission for Flight Studio, which was really born out of Steve's passion and personal mission for the Diary of a CEO, which is really to inspire everyone everywhere to pursue a more fulfilling life, one conversation at a time. So we're all united around that goal. And so much of that goal is about the relationship that we want to have with the audience that we are intending to reach.
Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes Sinclair.
Hey, it's Phil, and in this episode of Partnership Plus, we talk with Georgie Holt. Georgie is a career professional in media. She has done some amazing roles, and today is no exception. She leads and co-founded Flight Studio, and if that name rings a bell, it's probably because it is the home of Stephen Bartlett's A Diary of a CEO. We cover so many amazing points in this interview, and most importantly, there's a question that lives inside this conversation, which is a timeless one, one that you can put into practice right now that I think will change the game for many people that you know. And I'm super excited for you to hear this episode. So without further ado, let's meet Georgie Holt. So Georgie Holt, I have been a longtime fan of you and your work, and I am so thrilled that you've come to join me on Partnership Plus today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. What a joy.
People are going to get to know about a pretty spectacular career in media, all sorts of media, and we'll leave the most recent chapter towards the end because there's some amazingly fun things going on in the world right now, which you're helping to drive given all your experience. But before we get to that, let's start with Georgie's backstory. Who is Georgie?
How far back do you want to go? Like all the way back to 1980? That's probably not that interesting, if I'm honest. We'll start with the professional stuff.
Let's do it.
I found myself in sort of the media space. I had a deep desire actually to kind of pursue a really decent career in journalism. But quickly found out I probably wasn't as good as some of the journalists I was ended up hanging around with. So I wanted to work in media. I knew how much of an influence it had on me. And this was way before the years of social media. I mean, decades before social media arrived. I was consuming every single magazine I could read. I was watching what would probably be considered pop culture, everything I could possibly watch on TV, even though there was only four or five channels back then. So I knew I wanted to be around people who were making that thing happen. And I graduated from university, degree in politics. I was supposed to do English. Can I swear?
You bet.
Just wanted to check. I fucked up my A-levels, didn't get to the degree course I wanted to do and ended up doing politics. It was actually great because I spent 3 years debating and negotiating with a group of 50 people, and it was probably the best skills base I'd ever had going into any career that I went on from there. So
yeah,
it really did. And I found my way to London, lived in essentially a council house in a pretty rundown block, and just knew I had to get into media, and it was something I was so passionate about. And I ended up sort of in a sales path, really, sort of selling pages and magazines, you know, getting Procter & Gamble to buy a page of advertising and a parenting title. So that was really how I got my start, and I was hooked. I was hooked on content. I mean, we wouldn't even call it back there content back then. I was just hooked. I was hooked on everything that it could achieve. And what I really mean by that, it was, you know, you could put a piece of work into the world, it could have a profound impact on somebody who was receiving that work, whether it was written, whether it was audio. And then I sort of found this ability to get passionate about the funding of that content. So really diving into the advertiser side, the commercial side, And I felt a real purpose in that. I was like, hey, I can really get this stuff funded. I can get this incredible work to as many people as I possibly can by ensuring that the funding was really strong. And that really sort of set the tone for my career for the sort of the next 20, 25 years. I sort of started to realize I needed to work in media environments where I was passionate about the content. So I really wanted to work in fashion. I really wanted to work in sort of what would be considered women's brands more loosely, and kind of found my way into that space. I worked on some amazing music titles as well, which was super fun. And really spent the next kind of 20 years climbing the ladder step by step, job by job. And I think probably from a personal pinnacle achievement, I found myself as publisher of Cosmopolitan for the UK. And I really felt like I had put together all the pieces that I had passionately committed myself to. And I think I'd really built a skill set around. And not only that, I was in a media environment that was really dedicated to seeing life through a feminist lens, but in a really light, fun, feisty way. So it wasn't sort of too serious, but we were all out there enjoying ourselves. You know, social media was absolutely dominating at that point in time in terms of how media was starting to think about where does the content go? How does it travel? Where are my audiences? We were the first magazine publisher to get onto Snapchat and start to think about how we are expressing ourselves in those channels. We were building one of the largest digital sites for female audiences globally. So I really felt like that was sort of I'd kind of hit peak from those kind of 20 years of kind of just gradually climbing the ladder and committing to the work. And then of course, podcasts arrived, and it was almost like magic. I get emotional thinking about how my life would have been if they had not arrived. And the thing I loved so much, it was so counterintuitive to what we were trying to create in every other media environment, which was shorter, faster, like more just the rapidity of content. Like how much could we engage an audience with the shortest amount of words, with the fastest paced video? And like, there was a place for that, and that was super fun and incredibly creative. But then podcasts appeared, and suddenly there was a space for like long form, and not just long form, but like nuance and multiple perspectives and opinions. And it was like at a time really when I felt that quality journalism, news journalism, was kind of being destroyed by this appetite, this insatiable appetite for short form. And these long form stories weren't finding a place anymore. And I could see what that was starting to do in culture. I could see what it was starting to do in opinion, that it you didn't have space to really go into depth on a topic. And that was so important to me, that we understood everyone's point of view. And podcasts came along, and my God, I was hooked. It was kind of like an embarrassing obsession where I just couldn't stop talking about them. I couldn't stop sharing them with friends. It was people like, oh, here she comes with another podcast recommendation. I was like, no, you have to listen to this one. It's so amazing. And I'd also found myself in a job that I truly loved at the time as well. I was exec director of Stylist, which was a huge magazine in the UK. It was one of those brands that really exploited and really sort of accelerated the freemium model. It was distributing a million magazines a week across London and Manchester. It had a huge digital footprint. It was really on the cutting edge, I think, of creativity and what it meant to produce magazines for women, and how we're kind of redefining what that, I guess, that need was at that time to create, I guess, more challenging ideas and covers, and move away from maybe the traditional magazine covers that you'd have on Cosmo, which was like, honestly, most of the cover lines I'd ever sign off was like how to get a great blow dry and how to give a good blow job. Like that was usually the cover line you'd be signing off. Yep. And I'm like, I think there's more. I think there's a little bit more to our lived experience than those two things. But like, it always sold magazines. So, and then I was loving my work at Stylist. I loved that team so much, but an opportunity presented itself to get into podcasting. And to be honest, I'd been really actively pursuing a path to try and get to anywhere that would allow me to combine sort of another passion with a purpose, which was like getting amazing content and journalism funded. Like I just had this like absolute desire to assist in any way. And I found myself in Acast, and I was running their UK operation. They're a phenomenal team over there. They were really dedicated to the creator economy. It was really enabling anybody with a microphone and a voice and an idea to like start to monetize their craft. And I loved that mission so much. And I started in that job, I think a week after we went into lockdown. So it was an extraordinary time to like move into a new role, to be running. I was running the UK operation at the time as managing director, and nobody knew what they were doing. We were all kind of sitting there going, so like, how do we even run a company? How do we even keep everybody safe? How do we lead? Yep. How do we show up? And I think it was this crazy time where we were all thinking like, on one hand, I think we all are thinking we might die and the people we love might die. But on the other hand, we know that we still have work to do and we still have a mission. And it was the most extraordinary time, one of the most extraordinary times of my career, to kind of see the dedication and passion that this team had to get this work out into the world. And I think at that time, the conditions were just so optimal for podcast success.
Absolutely.
And I don't, at the time, everyone was like, oh no, this is the end for so many, like people went in the cinema, they went outside, we weren't like consuming media in the traditional way, we were hooked on the news, we didn't know really how to think and what to watch, and was it okay to watch something entertaining and lighthearted, or like, did we have to stay in the lane where everything was incredibly serious and very scary? And I was in, I think honestly, so lucky to be in the right place at the right time where people suddenly found a profound, I think, relationship with these people who were able to articulate so much of what we were feeling, able to storytell, to take us away from like the dark stuff that was happening outside, and to kind of lock us into almost these parasocial relationships that we were craving so much, that we'd lost so much of. And we had all of this amazing talent that honestly had time on their hands. They weren't making TV, they weren't making movies. And they had an idea, and they were like suddenly able to creatively express themselves in ways that they were maybe not allowed to do in the formats that they had found themselves in. And yeah, it was amazing. It was such an amazing time. And then I was lucky enough to go over to...
What was one of the favorites that came out of that for you? Yeah, podcasts. What was your top two or three from the COVID days? Was like, oh, well, awesome.
My favorite podcast of all time is a podcast called Dolly Parton's America.
Yeah.
It kind of speaks to everything that is beautiful about that medium. The soundscaping is outrageously good. Mm-hmm. It takes a story that we wouldn't know unless someone had the intention, the intensity, and the drive to go and tell it. And then not only did they tell it, they got her in to help with that storytelling. And the sort of the concept of the show is that there is, and the name will escape me now, but there was some sort of analysis of the most popular recording artists in America every single year. And it's not just about records sold and gig tickets sold. It's like a sentiment analysis. Mm-hmm. And your assumption would be, well, it would, I mean, Taylor Swift wasn't so great big at the time, but like you'd be like, it's going to be Beyonce, it's going to be Lady Gaga, it's going to be Jay-Z. It's called like this assumption that you would have. And it was Dolly Parton. And she was able to unite intergenerationally. She was able to unite across parties and lines. And the whole concept of this podcast is why her, why her message, why her music? What is it about her that enables everybody to almost lay down their arms and kind of come together and enjoy her music and what she's done? And this is an incredible story of her life. And it was one to me that just spoke to so much of what was brilliant and beautiful about the medium at the time. And it's also got the greatest artwork of all time. If you haven't seen it, I recommend you go and check it out. It's incredible. And even if you're not a Dolly fan, like go and listen to that show because it's phenomenal.
Oh, she's a legend. She's a legend.
Yeah, a legend. Yep. Absolute legend. And then I was lucky enough to go to the US with Acast and sort of started to scale out their US operation, their North America and LATAM, and did that for 2 years. It was just such a gift. It was such an incredible experience to be in the US market, to learn more about how that was operating, what the potential was. And it's everything. It's just so big. Like it's so big and it's so exciting. And there's so much investment. There's so much optimism. I mean, we hit the the 2022 years when the ad economy crashed. So it wasn't quite as optimistic at that time, but like it just was so fun and it was so big. And at that point in time, I had met Christiana, my co-founder. I'm going to speak to her a lot about partnerships because she's one of the greatest partners in my life. And we had worked together for 4 years across ACOS UK and US and had spotted an opportunity, we thought, in Europe and APAC, she's Australian, that there was a performance marketing model that was being actualized in podcasts. So direct response advertisers were driving incredible outcomes through podcasts because of that parasocial relationship that I'd mentioned. Like a host would recommend a product, they'd then give an incentive for you to go and buy it, and then the conversion rates would just be insane. Yeah. So we've all heard a BetterHelp ad. We've probably all heard a Casper Mattresses ad. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this direct response opportunity, really growth marketing, performance marketing. But in the European and APAC market, everyone was still seeing podcast as a brand building opportunity. Yeah. And we really felt that we could go again and take that idea back to Europe, launch a company, and again, sort of scale revenue in this environment that we were both so passionate about, and get great results for brands at the same time, because we truly knew that this was such an effective model and it sort of served both sides, the buy and the supply. So it was for us just a no-brainer to take that leap, and ACAST were incredibly supportive of that. And that kind of takes us up to the bit that we're going to save till later. So that's
a little bit
of a long-winded one, and you can cut loads of that, but that's what brought me here today.
It's such a cool story. And I know that there have been partnerships laced all the way through this, so we're not going to sort of just glaze over that. We'll come back to that. I discovered Smartless through COVID, and I still look forward to that every single week when it comes out. I think the guys have done a really spectacular job with that one show, because it's just, you know, that it's still three friends catching up every week. And I think there is something that has persevered through COVID where everyone's sort of gone, I still like the connection, and I feel strangely and bizarrely close to these people. And I don't think I feel like I have the right to be this close, but it is almost an extended part of the family. It's really something.
Yeah, we had the same conversation last night around an amazing podcast called Shameless. I don't know whether it's on your radio. I think it's 3 or 4 amazing Australian journalists. I was sat with someone from Australia last night. We were talking about the show, and she's like, it's my home from home. Every time I dial in, put those headphones on, I'm back home with my friends. And it's such an important feeling for me. And I can't really explain why it means so much, and people are sort of getting emotional in that moment trying to really describe what these people have meant to them. And like, not only did what do they mean to them, they just talk about pop culture and Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce. Like, it's, but they do it, I think their tagline is I think it's like dumb content for smart people, and it's just so fun and so joyful, and they do such a great job at it. But like, just that moment of connectivity, it's like I'm at home every time I put my headphones on and listen to that.
It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
There is a lot of power in this medium. And I'm still surprised when people who I know or know from a long way out will comment on a podcast episode or a guest. Because as we just talked about before, whenever I have these conversations, it feels almost like a guilty pleasure. This is the side part of the work, which is just really fascinating. And I get, when I spoke to Ryan Hawke, one of my first guests, I'd been such a longtime fan of his. And his mantra is, speak to as many people as you can, learn as much as you can from everybody, and just make sure that you show up well prepared. And every single episode after that I listen to, I'm actively listening for the preparation in the episode to see how people have sort of constructed this, because producing this stuff is an art. And, you know, when I see what the kind of work that your shop that we'll talk about in a second does, and some of these other shows, it's really quite spectacular how much is in the background. Even if it's in a startup context, it's just so much that happens to make it sound brilliant.
Mm-hmm. You're so right. I mean, I can't wait to tell you the amount of preparation and research that goes into our podcast. It's probably one of the most extraordinary things about what we do. Stephen had Boris Johnson on the show yesterday.
Yes, indeed.
And we have an incredible research team whose entire working world is dedicated to providing the best possible guest briefing for Steve. These can be up to like 30-page briefings. Mm-hmm. They obsess around not just that person's story or milestones, they obsess around the data analytics, like what are people searching for on the internet around this topic? Like, how are we going to be in service of this, of an audience who want to know more about this topic, this person? And we're going to provide them not just with what we want to know, but what we know that they want to hear or to see. So they spend a huge amount of time not just researching a human, their achievements and the topic, but like really dialing into what an audience might be looking for on that specific topic. So we have a huge amount of like proprietary technology that we use, like API connectors, like to basically scrape the internet and scrape social media to understand like what people want to know. Because you can go into a conversation and think, well, what do I want to know? This person is interesting, but you have to still be in service of your audience.
That's it.
The reason Steve books the people he does and the reason the team book is that he has a genuine curiosity in who he wants to speak. Like, he has to want to speak to that person. That's like golden rule number one. I want to have a conversation with you for like maybe up to 6 hours. Mm-hmm. That has to come from like a deep, deep curiosity to know more, because otherwise you just stop loving the job, right? You just sit there and think, oh God, I like basically have a meeting with someone for 4 hours that I'm really not that interested in talking to. And then once that decision has been made, essentially a team of 30 wrap around that moment, from research to data science, to the editing team, to the social team. And we're just locked in to like, okay, how can we make this the best possible conversation we can? How can we be in complete service of the audience? How are we going to ask people questions perhaps that they've never been asked before, even though they have a high profile space in our lives? And making sure that we get to the human side of a lot of people. I think that was one of the things that stood out so much from the Boris Johnson interview is it's kind of easy to be tough on this guy. And I'm not saying that anything he did was okay, but like that is an easier choice. You just hold him to account, which Steve did phenomenally well. But like to then decide to try and get to the human, to try and understand this person in perhaps a way that we've never heard before, like that's just elite to me, to kind of spend the time also doing that.
Yeah, and the energy that takes. So folks, for what George is talking about here, and the organization that she co-founded is called Flight Studio. And Flight Studio is the home of the Diary of the CEO, Diary of a CEO. And Stephen Bartlett, who we're talking about, just this last week, they released a very long form interview, which I'm sure got cut down. I'm not sure how long it was in the raw form, but with Boris Johnson. And it was a very, very engaging, hard-hitting and compassionate and just fascinating conversation. And this is not a one-off. This feels like this happens more often than not with this group. And so it's we'll get into the aspect of the show in a second, but when you think about all of the relationships at play here, you know, you've got people who are doing massive amounts of research, reaching out to people's agents, trying to work out the scheduling. I know there's a makeshift studio that looks identical that sort of gets transported somehow to the US, and there's obviously one that's permanent in the UK. What degree of the partnership sphere is happening in your shop to make all of that work? Because it's not the only show you work on. So tell us about the partnership ecosystem that you have at your fingertips every day.
Yeah, it's extensive. I think we sort of come back to this, the fundamental idea that a company is people and people are relationships. And we come from a place that we are incredibly mission driven. And the mission for Flight Studio, which was really born out of Steve's passion and personal mission for the Diary of a CEO, which is really to inspire everyone everywhere to pursue a more fulfilling life, one conversation at a time. So we're all united around that goal. And so much of that goal is about the relationship that we want to have with the audience that we are intending to reach, but also with the people that we are guesting on the show. Like, that relationship is super important as well, because if you don't treat that with the highest degrees of respect and always looking for the kind of 1% and the optimizations in every way, we're a company that is deeply committed to experimentation with Stephen. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he's an innovator and a unique creative, but we're driven by 1%. And a lot of the 1% we put into our work is actually about the people experience. So we have Slack channels dedicated to 1%, and we share all of the ways that we are like optimizing a relationship through either the content we're creating, so the relationship we have with the audience that we want to reach, or the relationship that we have with guests, our agent network, our publishers, our advertisers. And I'll give you a great example of that. I'll give you a couple. So when we think about the guest, we spend a lot of time sometimes onboarding them to the idea of being a guest on the show. Of course they know, of course they understand what the diary CEO can do. But as you probably also know, high profile people quite often want a lot of control around that conversation. They want to have the questions ahead of time. They want to ensure that you don't talk about specific topics that's off limits for them. And we say no to all of those things. We don't want to not talk about something that we know that the audience is interested in hearing because we've done the research. And we want to make it an organic conversation. And when people have a list of prepared questions, sometimes that can like almost deprogram them from the moment. So we spend a lot of time getting people comfortable that this is going to be an amazing conversation that will have a profound impact on an audience and potentially a profound impact on the guest as well. Most of them have promo. There's something in their work that they need to and want to be talking about. And we've got insane evidence that I think 80% of people who've had a book to promote or talking about a book during the time they're on the Star of a CEO, that book has gone to number one in Amazon. So like we know that the impact for them is going to be powerful, but we have to think about that relationship in the smallest of ways, every single 1%. So we obsess about the music our guests like. So they have a unique playlist when they enter the room that is some of their favorite songs. And you'll so often hear someone saying, I love this song. And we're like, we know. We have a unique fragrance that we scent the room with. And that fragrance is highly identifiable. Like as soon as I get anywhere near it, I'm like, oh, I'm in the studio. But also it's the fragrance is set to kind of evoke a sense of calm, but also there's some like energizing like scents in there. So like we really think about that. Stephen has a CO2 monitor in the room as well, because we know that when the CO2 levels get too high, actually you can get fatigued and you're like, you can just feel a little bit like, oh, woozy. So we monitor the CO2, we monitor the temperature when people come in and out. We had a really fun 1% recently. You mentioned that the team take the show to LA and New York, pop up an entirely new studio, build the same thing, absolutely identical to the front, like to the point where we play a great game when they're like, is this New York or is this London? And like we have to be like, oh God, I think it's London. Where they realize, I don't know how this is possible, but they realize they were an 8-minute walk from the nearest coffee place in the studio in Brooklyn. I don't know how that's technically possible, but it somehow in Brooklyn, there is a studio that's 8 minutes walk from the nearest, I think, very good coffee place. I think they were like, actually, there's one near, but it's not great. And everybody needs and wants coffee. They worked out, they calculated how many minutes of walking time that would take away, how much that might impact the guest experience, that we might not be able to get their coffee to them in the moment, that we might take too long, that might disrupt their flow. They might feel anxious about where that coffee was. They calculated all of that and they were said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go and invest in a really, really quality coffee making machine. They went and did that. They put it into the studio. They got like aprons made up with the branding on, and it became such a unique experience, and everyone loved it. They kind of felt like it was such a fun part of their experience. But like, that is how the team think all the time. So that relationship for us is just a series of 1%, a series of improvements. You know, from as simple things like what happens if it's raining when the guest arrives, we've now got branded umbrellas to like walk them to the studio, because quite often people have had glam and they want to look their best. And it's just all of those things are just genuinely about ensuring that the moment that person sits down in that chair with Steve, and everybody just, we never say we're going, we just sort of visibly step away from the step away from the space. There's no sort of like 3, 2, 1, go. There is just like a gentle leaving of humans from the room. So it's just Steve and the guest. And then they go. And if we don't do that thing, that conversation, that relationship that Stephen has with that guest would not be potentially as good. And it could, for whatever reason, not deliver the best conversation that they could possibly have. So we're thinking about it every single minute of every single day. And I think about it every single minute of every single day, because I have an incredible responsibility for these people and to make sure that they feel like they can have the best relationship with each other. They can think about how they can have the best relationship with their network or people that matter. So yeah, it's everything to us, everything.
And the product speaks for itself. I mean, for anyone who has not experienced the diary, and we'll talk about the other shows in a second, but there is something about, you can be guaranteed you're going to be educated and you're going to be inspired and you're going to be reminded about humanity and you're going to be just left feeling a little bit better that there are these stories being told. And the long form is so important as well. We've seen the massive shift back towards long form, and I think that's just so important because people need time to digest these stories and make sense of them. Georgie, when you think about all of these partnerships, all the things that you have to navigate and understand, whether that's cross-border, because you are obviously cross-border trying to do things in the US and also in the UK, what is the fundamental building block to these partnerships mm-hmm. for you? And there's a question in the rapid fire at the end around how you, what the first step is you take when you sense opportunity for a partnership. What do you do?
It's a great question. We have a really unique set of values at Flight Studio, at our company. And we have one, I think, that really speaks to relationships, which is kind of the founder mentality. And what it means to us is that we're driven by an intense amount of self-belief in our work, self-belief in each other. But I think you sort of have to quite quickly work out like what that self-belief is on the other side. What are they believing that they want to do with their work? People call it intrinsic motivation. But for me personally, and I think for a lot of people that work with us, is that we really want to get to your why pretty fast. Yeah. Because as soon as you can start to understand that a little better and you can find the intersection of your whys, like that is such a powerful thing.
Absolutely.
And for us, like the founder mentality really speaks to that, because a lot of founders, you work with a lot of them now, like there's a really big why in there somewhere, because it's really hard. And, you know, being high profile or dedicating your life to a field of medicine or sport or psychology, like that is like lifelong work. And there is usually a profound why underneath that commitment. I work personally very hard to try and figure that out. Like what's my self-belief and then what's your self-belief? And is there something that sits in between that unites us around an idea? It also means that we have an intense sense of urgency as well. Urgent teams win. So when we have an idea, we don't say, okay, who's going to go away and write up the notes? Who's going to go and write the deck? Who's going to go and like sit back at their desk and think about it for another 24, 48 hours, and then maybe we'll come back to it next week. We're like, who can you call? Like so often the first question we ask is, who can you call? Who do we know? And who is going to call them? Mm-hmm. And who is going to like reach out? So like, I have not sat in a brainstorm at Flight Studio. Like it's not that type of encounter. We're just like, everyone just pile in, bring the ideas, bring the energy, bring the optimism. And like, what's the first urgent step that we can take? How can we go and validate this idea as quickly as possible? Is it a phone call? Is it diving into the social channels and asking a question on Stephen's LinkedIn, or Stephen posting something, or any of our Flight Studio podcasters posting something on LinkedIn to get some sort of validation that we are on the right path here? So the founder mentality speaks to an intense amount of self-belief, an intense amount of urgency. And this idea, like the kind of walls are made of paper and the world is very malleable around you if you kind of work in that way. So relationships and partnerships can actually be forged exceptionally quickly and then nurtured over a really long amount of time. So I think you can make them fast, but the real skill is in the nurturing of that. And that for me is like that aligning of our beliefs or self-belief and understanding like when I'm showing up in this meeting, in this conversation, in this moment, that I'm here for this reason and you're here for that reason. And some days those reasons do not line up at all. And it's about understanding when those moments are and maybe taking a step back and saying like, not today, but like call me whenever that feels like it's closer to where you want to be. So I think the founder mentality speaks to how we approach relationships and how we approach partnerships is like urgency and then nurture. And those two things can really be such a powerful combination when done well.
I have a strong feeling that you also lead with generosity as well. There seems to be a version of a number of the teams I've interacted inside Flight Studio where there is a default generosity position taken. And, you know, Ryan Hawk talks about this idea of a trust wager. You know, you can lead with generosity and offer trust, or you can demand trust to be earned. And I think the latter is a very boring way to live life, frankly, a pretty sad way to live life. But if you lead with that point of generosity, it is so uncommon that you'll often get off to such a better start in a relationship. Tell me a little bit about a partnership that you've had at Flight Studio which has exceeded your expectations.
There's so many. I feel even bad like trying to reduce it to one. I think the partnership and relationship I have with my co-founder Christiana, I think that's been one of the most impactful, important experiences of my entire life. And we work hard at it every single day. I'd say we operate more like sisters in the way that we can like speak our minds without any need for filter. We can get through issues super fast. Like we can disagree on a topic, say why we disagree, move away, and within 10 minutes, like, we're okay, I've thought about what you've said, and I actually do think that you're probably right. So like, we have this incredible relationship, and I wouldn't be able to do this without her. So I feel deeply sort of committed to talking about how important like a double act is in work and life. And I think we seek so much in our personal lives around partners and friendships, and we know the power of like that duality of spirit and sort of two people fighting for something together, and we seek that very much in our personal lives, but like the power of seeking that in your professional life and finding like a partner at work, and that can happen in multiple spaces. It doesn't have to be co-founder. It can be someone in the marketing team, someone in the editing team. Like this idea that the duality of your ideas and your spirit and your energies can almost be 1+1=3 every single time. So I think she's had a profound impact on the partnership aspect. And then I get to work with incredible, I can't even call them talent. Like it's such a crazy, we've never really got the right name for like people who are just shit hot at what they do and bring like an insane amount of energy, curiosity and passion to an idea. But I think maybe if I was going to take it down to one, I think probably someone like Davina McCall, and maybe, you know, to your audience, she is one of the greatest broadcasters in British history. We grew up with her on our TV. She was the host of Big Brother. Like she just really cemented like late 90s, early 2000s culture. She's had an incredibly diverse life. She's gone through huge personal struggle. She is a woman in the second act of life, who still has the energy and enthusiasm to, it's not even attack a problem. It's, she knows that with her work and with her words that she can sort of energize a group of people, particularly in midlife, particularly who have kind of maybe thinking that the second act is sort of a downhill slope and you're just kind of sliding into retirement, that things are only opportunity, risk, great sex, great ideas are like something you should have done before you're 45, because after that it's like it's not possible for you now. And she just absolutely rebels against that idea.
Love it.
And every single interaction I have with her, I walk away honestly thinking I can take on the world. Like this person inspires me in such a profound way that I walk away and just want to like honestly run through a wall. And I think when she puts the show into the world, it launches next week, the 17th of October. I know that she's going to change lives with the work that she does. And she brings so much of her true self. You know, there's tears, there's laughter, there's shock, surprise, awe in every interaction and conversation she has. So I think to see someone who lives themselves and every emotion so clearly, but then uses it as a way to inspire others, it's just had such a profound impact on me. And I'll do everything I possibly can every single day to make that the biggest show in the world. That's my goal.
It's amazing. You mentioned a couple of times the word nurturing relationships, and this idea I think is something that many people don't seem to be able to get their arms around. From a quick text message to say, how are you doing, to really engaging with somebody deeply for a short or a long time. When you think about this idea of nurturing a relationship to get, you know, to forge something that's going to go for decades, what are you doing? What sort of things are you doing to try and make sure that they stay front of mind for you? And, you know, you run such a busy ship, you know, but you still find time for this. So I'm just curious, you know, for people who are commercial relationships and people who are inside your team, you've spoken about them to date, but how do you think about that idea of nurturing? Because one of the things that I tell often to people is, if you do nothing else, just remember somebody's birthday.
So true. And it's, I'm going to speak to a couple of things in that. First, I'm going to speak to the culture of our company. We celebrate every birthday. We celebrate every milestone. Every day I'm hearing like clapping and cheering, and there's always cake. And so like, it's in our culture that we sort of show up like that for each other. So I think if you're showing up in your company like that for each other, that, you know, the smile on someone's face when they get the birthday balloons and the card, and you're like, yeah, I mean, who knows what's going on outside of work on that day for that person. But if you can show up for them and like nurture that moment with it, it's so powerful. So we make it part of our culture. So we're constantly celebrating each other, our milestones and sort of significant events in our lives. So that's a really important part. So that sort of then travels outside.
Definitely.
And I think the idea of nurturing for me is always coming from a place of, how can I add value to you? Not what's the value you're going to add to me in this moment in time. So I'm always listening, that kind of idea of like, what's your motivation? What's your belief? Where are you today? There was an incredible podcast episode with the Gottmans, John and Julie Gottman, who are like some of the greatest relationship counselors and psychiatrists in the
great
world.
Episode.
They were on with Paul C. Brunson. Yeah, amazing episode. They were on with Paul this week. And they asked that one of the parts of the podcast, they said, and this is how thinking about how you apply it to your personal partner, but I think this can translate into the work as well, is the question to ask is not how are you, not how was your day, is what was it like to be you this week? And I just, that question, just,
God, what a question.
It stopped me in my chat.
Yeah.
Honestly, what was it like to be you this week? And I thought about being asked that question myself, and I almost sort of tear up thinking about asking it. I'm like, why is it that just that subtlety in the change of that question, because it places you as the highest value in that conversation. What was it like to be you? It leads with curiosity, it leads with love, it leads with wanting to kind of deeply understand someone else's position. And I just thought, what happened if we just all went into every meeting, every interaction, and said, what was it like to be you this week? Tell me. And if someone said, you know what, it was really hard, and I'm struggling with this project, and I feel like I'm feeling vulnerable about asking for help. And then you're like, okay, well, like, can I help you? So I think that sort of idea of the nurturing is not just connectivity. It's the question you ask when you are connecting. I'm a big believer in sort of the immediacy of our communication is such a gift, because I will often think of someone that I maybe haven't seen or spoken to for a while, and I will just voice note them and say, I was walking down the road and I just thought of you, and I don't need anything. I just want to know I'm thinking of you, and I hope you're doing great, and I'd love to see you, and that's it. Like, I just wanted to tell you that you were on my mind. And I think sort of that centering of another in your sort of your mind and putting them as like, I just thought of you. And like, how often in the day do we think of someone else I must see that person. I must call them. I must say something. We have like a device. We have a device that can record welded our voice in 20, like 20 yeah. welded. Like it's like a, it's a limb. It's like something I panic when I'm not even close to, but it's, you know, that's a bad thing, but it's also an incredibly good thing. It takes 20 yeah. seconds to step away and say, I was thinking of you today. Hope you're doing well. Give me a call. And they might send a voice note back going, hey, that's so weird. I was thinking of you too. And then you're like, that's weird. Like we were just having this sort of interconnected moment across the universe. And that can just be a really fun thing to do. But I think that idea of it's not just sort of nurturing and turning up. It's like turning up in a way that makes that person feel nurtured and at the center of your thinking. And I just thought that question from the Gottmans was so powerful, and I'm going to use it all the time. Like, what was it like to be you this week? And I think for like a manager, a leader of teams, a partner, a friend, a sister, a son, whatever that is like, what an incredible thing. What a gift to give someone that question to answer as well.
There are many people who are going to receive that question from me now who will not be able to make sense of it until they listen to this episode, and now they'll know why. It's a brilliant, brilliant question. Georgie, I could talk to you for days, and we have plenty more to cover. So I think we might do another one of these, but I know that you have a big day coming up in the UK. So I want to respect that and get you into that day quickly. Before I do, I have one question and then I have a rapid fire for you. So the one question for you is, given everything that's happening in the world right now with everything, you know, there's a lot of division, there's still a lot of love and compassion, but we're seeing a lot that is making, I think, a lot of people quite nervous. When we think about this from a leader's point of view, there is a role, I think, an antidote to a lot of the division is to seek partnership. And that could be at a personal level, it can be cross-border, cross-organization. What do you think leaders are missing about that at the moment? Why are they not doing that more?
I think we've forgotten how to pay attention sometimes. And I think we've talked about devices and social, like we are constantly, our attention is in this thing right here. Mm. And, you know, we're told through marketing surveys, through thought leadership that, you know, our attention span is like now 8 seconds and everything's like whatever it is. I'm probably about 3 seconds now for most people. Mm. And like, it's just getting shorter and shorter, and our attention is being fought for in every single moment of every day. And I think one of the most important things, and it's something I challenge myself with all the time, is are you paying attention to the smallest of interaction that you can see across a room, which is why I'm so passionate and probably counter to a lot of people's current working styles. I believe that we should be working in real life together. Mm. I passionately believe that being together is one of the most important human experiences that we can have. And of course, flexible working is important to meet people's needs where they are, but being together is for me the only way you can build. It's the only way that you can really connect people around a belief, an idea. And it's honestly one of the real ways that you can pay attention. So I can tell when my attention is completely misaligned, or I think something happened here and I wasn't paying attention is quite often how I think. Mm. So if I am in a meeting or I am in a moment, even like digitally, I'm like, something, I wasn't paying attention to something. And that to me is like such a flag in my leadership that I am not present. I'm not paying attention. So it is really hard. We're in a really difficult spot from a media, culture, geopolitical, mental health, economic. I mean, it's exceptionally challenging, and I don't have the answers to the biggest questions in the world. I don't, like, I'm just trying to lead with curiosity and empathy and take a responsibility for the outcomes that I have to do as a leader, and are such a responsible, I would take that responsibility so seriously. But my responsibility is to pay attention.
Yeah.
And if I'm not doing that, then I'm actually not doing my job. And that to me is like the number one KPI I give myself is paying attention. Because when you do, you can answer those really big questions, because you can understand that like intrinsic motivation, that self-belief, that why, what was it like to be you this week? And that kind of stuff can move you through some of the biggest questions and the biggest problems. So yeah, I think it's the attention that you can give your people. I know we're all busy. I know there's 1,000 emails, 5,000 Slacks, 20 crises, 20 A-plus problems, 50 things that you should have done yesterday. Yeah. But if you're not paying attention to your people, then you're not showing up as a leader.
Love it. All right. Rapid fire. Let's get through this and we're going to get you into your day. All right. Question number one.
You're so sweet. Thank you so much.
No, not at all. Your first question, Nick, complete this sentence. Partnership is?
Life.
What content are you loving at the moment?
I'm a pop culture junkie. I'm an addict. I will say that out loud in any circle that it needs to be said in. So I'm absolutely loving Shameless Media right now.
Awesome. What's the worst piece of advice you've received and why?
I think the worst... this is difficult because I really thought about this question, and I don't actually think there's such a thing as bad advice. I don't.
Interesting.
I think people are quick to pull out a trope. I think they're quick to pull on something they've read in a managerial book or they've seen on Instagram. So I think that is pointless advice, because I go on Instagram too, and I also saw that post. I think there isn't bad advice. I think it can be pointless or mistimed. So I would still try and listen to what someone is trying to tell me in that moment. And maybe they saw a quote on Instagram and they were like, I should probably tell Georgie that she should change and do something in this direction. Yeah. I think it's pointless versus bad. And there's been some pointless advice over time, because I'm like, I could go on Etsy and buy that quote if I wanted to, kind of advice. I'd say it's pointless versus bad.
All right. Question number four. We touched on this briefly before, but when you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn that potential into action?
Something, anything. Pick up the phone, send an email, be urgent, make it your number one priority. Don't leave the meeting until you like literally step away from the meeting, text someone, WhatsApp someone, voice note them, send an email. Don't think, just do. Because you just don't know. Like, it's just do as fast as you can, as quickly as you can. Don't overthink it. Send the, because you just don't know. That is how I ended up working with Stephen Bartlett. Like, we just sent the email, and like that has changed the course of my life.
Well, that's how we,
and we didn't overthink it, and we sent it.
Well, that's how we got to know each other. It's like, just send the email.
Exactly.
Let's see what happens.
Yeah.
That's exactly how it works. Okay. Final question. What's one thing you're deeply grateful for right now?
To be having the biggest adventure of my life, about to turn 45. I want every single person to know, and I had this conversation with someone last night at Spotify who's probably in a similar age demographic to me, who is taking the hugest, hugest leap into something new. And I just said, isn't that just the greatest gift? That life can continue to be full of surprises and adventure, and it isn't something you complete by 30, that it's a mindset. And sometimes like taking a huge risk from a place of experience and time, which hopefully equals some kind of wisdom, I don't know, I kind of hope that that's what starts to happen, I'm still not sure. Isn't that just the most incredible thing? And doesn't that make life just the most wonderful experience? And I just think, the older you get, you should take more risk, because you actually have more data and you have more validation and like what you are and aren't able to do or what you think you can and can't do. And for me, that's the thing, is it's just the greatest gift to having a huge adventure at this stage in my life. And I wake up every single day and truly thank every person that has ever put me or got me to this place, because I didn't do it on my own. There are so many mentors and colleagues and friends and family that support everybody on this journey. So yeah, I think that's it for me.
What an answer. Georgie, it has been such a pleasure to spend some time with you. I feel like we're going to talk again soon. Thank you again.
And I hope so.
Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, and enjoy the pizza. I hope everybody gets what they want tonight on the family dinner table. And I really hope you go and ask that question as well. I'd be really curious to see how your kids answer that too, because I feel like it's a question that's intergenerational.
I'm going to ask it as soon as I walk in the door. Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.